This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The global economy has a parallel underground illicit market where everything is sold, from bootleg DVDs and fake Gucci accessories to machine guns, rocket launchers, illegal drugs, endangered species, cadavers, and sex slaves. My guest Moises Naim has written a new book called Illicit: How Smugglers, Traffickers, and Copycats Are Hijacking the Global Economy. Naim is the editor of the magazine Foreign Policy, which is published by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's the former executive director of the World Bank and served as Minister of Industry and Trade in Venezuela. Now, you write that the people who are investigating illicit markets and trying to crack them have used the mafia as the model, but the networks have changed. You say they're really more decentralized, like Al-Qaeda, than they are like the mafia. Can you give me an example of a illicit network that looks more like Al-Qaeda than the mafia?
Well, imagine we have evidence of Ukrainian arms runners and traffickers of women that are in alliances with Colombian and Mexican traffickers, in which they traffic and exchange, for example, weapons for cocaine. Or we have found there is evidence of Nigerian traffickers working in northern Thailand. This is not a structured hierarchical organization that has a boss and therefore several underbosses and is a pyramid. These are very flexible, very agile, stateless networks that develop opportunistic arrangements, and that if they work together for a while, then disassemble, then do it again. And what's evident now is that the specialties are no longer as important as the ability to move illicit goods, services, people from across borders. So a network can, in Morocco, for example, can move to Spain both drugs, weapons, or people. The same we have seen in the border between Mexico and the United States, where traditional drug-running networks now also operate in running people and arms.
So even the drug trade isn't like the big South American drug cartels like it used to be?
The drug trade has changed in very important ways. New entrants, new people, new groups, new networks are operating. A lot of the drugs are no longer harvested but cooked. We have in the future of the drug trade is not harvesting something and then moving it to another country, but cooking it in makeshift labs or very even industrial labs in some countries. It has also changed in the sense that traditional countries that were transshipment countries have now become big markets. For example, Brazil, that used to be a transshipment place for drugs produced in the Andean countries, in Peru, in Bolivia, in Colombia. Now Brazil is a huge market and continues also to be a transshipment place. And there are new products. Technology has changed the drug trade. A very important drug trade that accounts for $7 billion a year takes place in the Pacific Northwest, where there is an export from Canada called BC Bud, British Columbia Bud, which is a type of marijuana that is very potent and very sought after by consumers and distributors. That trade did not exist a few years ago, and it now exists thanks to changes in technology. They have adapted and used biotechnology. You know, marijuana is no longer produced only in the tropical places. It can be produced in very cold places, like British Columbia. So there is technology, and technology that is biotechnology, technology that is communications technology, that uses all sorts of new means, from calling cards to the internet to BlackBerries to pagers to very low costs of transportation, that were one of the changes of the 90s, have facilitated these illicit trades of all kinds.
And another problem you point out is that authorities are often willing or happy to take bribes and payoffs, kickbacks from the illicit drug traffickers.
Yes. What I point out is that illicit trade, the criminal trades, have grown in ways that has changed them. They have mutated into activities that we have not seen before in history. They are now global. They are now very, very wealthy. They are connected internationally to politicians. They are if you are very successful in business, the three things you do is that you diversify first. Second, if your industry is highly regulated, you get very close to government officials and to regulators. And third, if you're very successful, you also buy legitimacy by donating money to orchestras, sports clubs, churches, good works of all kinds. The illicit traffickers are also doing that. They are very successful. They have piles and piles of money. And their industry is very regulated. Indeed, it is banned. So the return on their investment in government relations, in getting close or even owning governmental officials and agencies, is very high, as is their investment in legitimacy, in social acceptance. And the more that happens, the more money they have, the closer they get to government officials, the more the whole apparatus of policies in countries, in entire countries, gets compromised and even captured by the interests of illicit traders.
Let's look at the illicit arms trade. And you say the biggest factor since the end of the Cold War in the illicit arms trade was the transformation of the former Soviet bloc and its effect on arms producers there. You say virtually every country in Central and Eastern Europe has a small arms industry.
Yeah, there is a proliferation of small arms, and it's not only in the former Soviet Union. Yeah, you now find very important arms, small arms production in places like Ghana or Chile, or even in East Asia. And what's happening is, it's very interesting to see how it is banned, it is prohibited, there are all sorts of embargoes, but we have not heard the first instance of an insurrection as an armed group, a guerrilla group that has gone out of business because it lacks weapons or ammunition. So this is another trade that is completely prohibited and banned in many ways for civilians around the world, and yet it thrives.
Since 2004, it's no longer a criminal offense in the United States to own a military-grade assault weapon. Is that affecting the international arms trade and the illicit arms trade?
No insurgency, no guerrilla movement in the world has lacked for suppliers of weapons. So the United States is just one, albeit a very important one, but it's not the only one. And the regulations or the freedom with which weapons are produced and sold in the United States is certainly a very good opportunity for these traders. A former president of Colombia, President Pastrana, told me when he learned that the United States has deregulated and allowed the free production and sales of this assault weapon, he was indignant. He told me that day in and day out, very honest, decent policemen and judges and law enforcement officials in Colombia are gunned down with American-made weapons. And that while they're trying, that if they did that, they would probably be put in a blacklist somewhere. Whereas in the United States, this production of weapons and the freedom with which these weapons are made available creates interesting, attractive opportunities for traders and drug traders and criminals of all kinds. But again, I don't want to just center it in the United States because it's not the main source. It is a very important source, but as I said before, weapons are plentiful.
I think, like most Americans, don't directly encounter the illegal arms trade and don't directly encounter the illegal narcotics trade, but probably many Americans do encounter illegal goods, knockoffs of fashions, handbags, Gucci's, Prada's. When did that become so big, the illegal knockoff, the international illegal knockoff industry?
It grew. It always existed, but it was always of low quality and easily recognizable. And today, you have a hard time differentiating a knockoff from the real thing. And it is, as I said before, a business that generates losses of about $630 billion a year to the legitimate owners of these trademarks and products. In the early 90s, these trades existed, and the counterfeited products, the trade in counterfeited products, did exist. But it was not as huge as it is now. That has to do with the emergence of China, with outsourcing of production of a lot of these goods in China, by the legitimate owners and by the opening of the world trading system that was deregulated and by the ability of these traders to connect in complex ways through the networks. If you go in any of the streets of the major capitals, if you go and walk in the streets of Manhattan, you will see that a lot of the people that sell these counterfeited products are illegal immigrants themselves. If you go to Europe, you'll find that they are also illegal immigrants and very often from the same countries. They may not know each other. But that tells you that there is a very interesting connection between the people's trade and the counterfeiting trade. Just imagine the difficulty of stealing a product designed in Europe, moving it to China, copying almost identically, and putting it, manufacturing it in huge volumes, and distributing it in the street corners of all the major capitals. And this happens very quickly. All of the people, the industries that are victims of these trades will tell you that their products are copied almost at the speed of light. Very often, they are released by the counterfeiters earlier than the official release of the product by the legitimate owner. So if you think in terms of the managerial challenges entailed of doing all of these things, all of the steps involved, and then you add the fact that most of them are illegal, then you conclude that this is impossible without huge complicity on the parts of governmental officials.
In analyzing the illicit trade of arms and drugs and knockoffs, did you go on the road into some of these capitals of illegal business and try to see for yourself what's going on?
Yes, I did. I did visit not all of them, but I visited quite a few of them. I also met with all sorts of actors involved in this, law enforcement officials and prosecutors, and also some of the traders themselves. In the book, I talk about a person I call Don Alfonso. Don Alfonso is a very successful, quote-unquote, legitimate business man in Mexico, who is very proud of the fact that his two, his son and his daughter go to Ivy League universities in the United States. He has a construction company. And then one day he discovered that the trucks in his construction companies were being used by his employees to move, quote-unquote, things across the border. And he discovered that because he had a very hard time retaining the drivers. He discovered that there was a very high turnover among the drivers. And lo and behold, he discovered that the drivers in just one short trip using the trucks of the company were able to make several years' worth of the salaries that he was paying them. And so one day, Joe, almost half-jokingly, he told one of his trusted employees that, you know, if they were using the trucks of the company, they should reward the company for that, and that is how he started by financing and allowing the transfer of drugs across the border. And he joked that everybody was involved in this, and that in the border between Mexico and the United States, it's very hard to have illicit legal activity that is not touched in some way, directly or indirectly, by the illicit trades of people, drugs, and other things.
Do you think that the research you've done into illegal manufacturing and sales networks has any implications for homeland security in the U.S.?
Yes, I think it has huge implications. As a result of doing this and trying to understand how can it be contained, I did look quite carefully into the workings of the governments, and not only the U.S. government. And the first thing you discover is how fragmented is the workings of the government. For example, the illicit trade in counterfeits is centered in the Commerce Department, whereas the drug trafficking is the Drug Enforcement Agency. The trafficking in people is centered in the State Department, but there are also several other agencies in government. The money laundering is at the Treasury Department. And each one of them talks to each other, but they belong to different organizations with different bosses, with different priorities, different budgets, and great difficulties in coordinating their activities. And that is just within one government. And just imagine that all of these traders thrive in being international. Governments are very good at working inside the borders of the country. Government and government agencies have a very hard time working in other jurisdictions, in other countries. Traffickers and illegal traffickers thrive instead in working across borders. So you have agencies, government agencies, that are bound and restricted by the national borders, and you have traders that are exploiting the possibility of moving stealthily and very effectively across borders, and that thrive in the in-between between sovereign nations.
In your book, Illicit, you say that you think civil wars, failed states, really make life a lot easier for that illegal economy, for that criminal economy. I'm wondering if you think that the war in Iraq and the chaos now in Iraq is having any effect on the illicit network of, you know, drugs and arms and other things.
There is no doubt that there is a lot of smuggling that is going on in Iraq of all kinds. The Minister of Finance of Iraq, Ali Alawi, told me the other day, that he is convinced that about half of the money that is now being invested or spent in Iraq in its reconstruction is being lost to illicit activities and corruption. It's very hard. There is no doubt that what is driving the Iraq insurgency and the Iraq instability is driven by politics and religion. But there is also no doubt that there is a lot of profit-making. There is a lot of violence, and there is a lot of instability that is driven by profit-making networks that are exploiting the situation to become immensely wealthy.
Moises Naim, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Moises Naim is the author of the new book, Illicit.